We are blessed to have many scientists among us in our community and a few visitors who are also scientists. So I'm going to make effort to prove to them that Deuteronomy is an accurate account of the creation story. By the end of the day, I hope you give up on physics. As we know, this is a parasha and the early parshiot of Exodus that inspire a lot of conversation between science and faith. Best of which some of you have watched with me is a YouTube video of Stephen Colbert interviewing Ricky Gervais. There's another similar video with Mayim Bialik where she doesn't understand when he says the words Nephilim. He keeps talking about the Nephilim, she has no idea what she's talking about because I'm sure she doesn't recognize the word Nephilim pronounced incorrectly. But I think that's a fool's errand to try to reconcile science with Torah. Torah doesn't propose itself to be a book of science or history. It proposes itself to be a Torah, which literally means instruction or teaching. And as I've spoken before on the difference between truth and fact, I think that Torah is true, though not always factual. And I'd prefer truth to fact, much in the same way that I prefer watching Casablanca to watching a History Channel documentary about World War II. We can have different opinions on that. And I want to suggest that there is a thin fissure in our tradition of persons who were uncomfortable with supernatural theology. There are small elements, I would say, of what we might call proto-physics and proto-math, and a desire to understand our scripture as in accord with, if not modern science, physics, and quantum mechanics, at least in accord with Aristotelian and Greek understandings of the natural world. And among the things that make people incredibly uncomfortable are miracles, divine providence. They make me very uncomfortable for a totally different reason, because they create great theological problems of theodicy. If God can intervene to interrupt physics, why doesn't God stop childhood leukemia or tsunamis? That's not where I'm going today. But our sages, there is a small strand that was, if not dismissive of, potentially uncomfortable with the concept of miracles, the miraculous, the supernatural, things that transcended physics, places where 2 + 2 could equal 5. Maimonides was very strong on this, that God can do anything except things that are implausible. God can't make 2 + 2 = 5. But there is an earlier strand in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot that talks about the creation story of this week and suggests that just at the end of creation, just prior to the onset of the first Shabbat, at that twilight, in that liminal space, 10 things were created. These were the mouth of the earth that swallowed Korach, the mouth of the well that Miriam would carry, which was arranged somewhat like a bee's hive, if you ever hear the description, the mouth of the donkey, Balaam's donkey, the rainbow, the manna, Moses' staff that could incite miracles, turn into snakes, and so forth, the shamir, which is this mythical maggot that carves the stones of the temple such that they not see iron implements wielded upon them, and the writing, the inscription of the tablets, because the tablets were miraculously engraved, which creates a scenario, and Maimonides also liked this, that miracles are preordained interruptions in physics. We can't pray for miracles because physics continues irrevocably. Irresistibly, physics will persist. Miracles were inserted as a piece of creation, just as Newtonian mechanics, just as chemical equations, just as evolution by natural selection. So that's, again, a very thin counter tradition to concepts of the miraculous, the supernatural, and the providential. But the idea of applying one's intellect to the world and ascertaining, as John Locke would describe, natural law that persists and exists beneath our perceptions and transcends subjective judgment does exist. There is a fascinating word, if you turn to the very end of chapter 2 and the very beginning of chapter 3, Unless I'm mistaken, it's almost the exact same root. I find this fascinating. So at the end of chapter 2, we hear the description that Adam and Chava, the first of our ancestors, were naked. The word they use is arum. Don't check me on it. If I'm wrong, I'm not going to change my sermon. No, you should check, as I could be misunderstood. I've always thought about this, but I haven't triple-checked myself. So it says they were naked, arum, the man and the woman, and they were not ashamed. This is just a general translation, probably JPS. And then in the very next verse, the very beginning of the very next chapter, it says that the serpent is most shrewd. And the word they use is arum mikol hayat, more arum than any other beast. The humans were naked, arum, and that made them ashamed. Yet the serpent was arum, and that made him shrewd, it shrewd. And if you look at that root, ayin resh mem, it comes to mean heaped up or stripped down or crafty. Sort of the root of the discerning intellect, of the bina, if you look at the Kabbalistic imagery, that piece of the intellect which discerns and separates and is clear and analytic, that piece that is needed for computer programming, for mathematics, for particle physics. And somehow, I don't think it's the major tradition, but it is a small minor tradition or counter tradition, the idea of arimut, of that kind of craftiness is embedded in our tradition. Frankly, that's what Jacob is beloved for being crafty, shrewd. And there are places where there's this odd hint of what we would understand as somewhat like modern physics. Now, I'm sure you're going to correct me, because I haven't studied physics in 20 years, and the last class I took was mechanics with a Nobel laureate who was a terrible math teacher. And so sometimes your best teachers are not the people who are illuminated in their field. So I got lost in my first mechanics class and gave up. But we have, of course, the very first words of our Sefer Torah that Frank read on Simchat Torah, or Breshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. Breshit, a very vague and oddly constructed word that I don't want to give you too much translation. But more or less, the verse means, in the beginning of God's creation of the heavens and earth. So our late medieval commentator Sforno, who is from Italy in the 16th century, uses this word Breshit to mean before, at the beginning of time, that first indivisible moment before which time did not exist. Marcus and I have talked about the T value in equations, how time marches forward. I think Kierkegaard said, life can only be lived forward, but it can only be understood backwards. But there is T equals zero, correct? You know, there is a, no? Can we debate? Let's have the debate at Kiddush. Yeah. Whew, okay. Thank you. That's going to be the title of the sermon when I post it online. It's a brave man who gives a sermon on science in this congregation. But I love that concept. Whether it's accurate in post-Newtonian physics or not, it's a very powerful idea that time is a piece of the essence of God's creation of the universe. And Schneur Zalman of Liadi, the first of the Lubavitch Rebbes, the Alta Rebbe, has a beautiful statement. He wrote in the late 1700s. Why did God create the world only when God did? Why not a year, or 100 years, or a million years earlier or later, I guess he could have said, since whatever reasons God had for creation were certainly just as valid then. And he hammers on the point that I'm making, which is that time is itself part of creation. We can't ask why the world was not created earlier, since there is no stretch of time that can be termed as before creation. I don't know what this means theologically. I don't know what this means about God, but I find this statement very, somewhat like a Buddhist koan. The idea of time being an essential element to creation, I find very moving, frankly. I don't know if you will, but I find it enthralling that God made us in time. And we do understand Torah to be a book about God acting in history, but I would challenge it is not a history book. It was not published by Harcourt Brace Johanovich or Houghton Mifflin. Those books were never as inspiring to me as the Torah. But maybe that's the sense in which God acts through history, that God is the sum of time, the heart of the universe, Chei Olamim, the life of the universe, and God is those things because God is either is the T-value God's self, or God has created time as a principle. But regardless, it's quite lovely. And I'm not talking, I want to be clear, about intelligent design. Or I am. I don't know. This is a kind of a quantum argument about intelligent design. Pardon? It's a quantum, I'm sorry if I go too far into science for your non-scientists. This is the, I'm going to use quantum intelligent design as a Schrodinger's cat. We don't know if it is true or not, but there's something to it that inspires my theology, my belief about God, that there is architecture. That true faith is, the minimum of true faith is understanding that the world has meaning and purpose. Entropy is a challenge to that, but in the Midrash, Torah says, I was the tool of God's artistry, and the Midrash uses this imagery. An architect who builds a palace doesn't do so on her own. She has scrolls and notebooks which she consults with regarding how to place the rooms, where to set the doors. So it was with God. God looked into the Torah and created the world. And in the Zohar it said, man looks into Torah and sustains the world. So the idea, which is contained, if I recall correctly, in Proverbs and Psalms and other ancient literature, that there is a wisdom that sustains our life, and that wisdom ordains an architecture, and that's what makes creation work and makes creation powerful and meaningful and significant and heart-grabbing. That idea, I think, is a theological sine qua non, that without that idea, it pulls the pillars out of faith. You can believe whatever you want about the original quantum field or evolution by natural selection, and that may contradict scripture if you understand scripture to be factual and not true, or true and factual. But my sense is that all of those things are manifestations of God's might. And that the fact that God exists and creates and evolves and designs through extremely simple and astute and powerful and elegant principles is that's uplifting to me. That makes me believe in God more, not less. I was talking to another scientist who's not here today about string theory, which I always struggle with because I think it's... It always feels a little bit like the emperor's new clothes. We can't prove this, but trust me, it exists. But she says she finds it very elegant when you do the math, if you're one of those three people who can do the math. And so I find that really powerful. I don't find evolution by natural selection to be in contradistinction or problematic to our first chapters of Genesis. I find it phenomenal that through a very simple principle of genetic variation, mutation and selection, we have ants and humans and birds and bacteria over what's really a very small frame of time. I mean, that not that long ago in the scheme of things, there were creatures that were 60 feet tall. There were megafauna, there were dinosaurs. And my son is very into dinosaurs now, and I look at that and think, how did this exist at all in the same planet that we live in? Even if it was hundreds of millions of years ago, that doesn't even, to me, that doesn't feel like enough to make that significant a difference. I can understand us evolving from chimps, but I can't imagine creatures so dramatically different ever existing. Parenthetical. Do you know why people believe in dragons? Anyone know this one? The belief is that someone found dinosaur bones. Like, things like dinosaur jaw bones, and they were like, wow, this must be a dragon. And they think that werewolf, the myth of werewolves, came out of rabies. And the myth of vampires comes out of anemia. Total parenthetical, detour. But I want to leave you with something that I think is somewhat non-scientific, or maybe our scientists and mathematicians will correct me later. But in various traditions, we expand upon the idea of God being the originator of time and God being the architect of the universe. And differentiating God from an architect, differentiating God from a scientist. And this is in Baruch Shemar, one of the first prayers we say in the morning, that creation is not originating from a big bang and expanding outwards. It is a continual process. That every morning and at every instant, God renews creation. I think this is somewhat non-scientific, but this is for everyone else who suffered through the math. In various books, it says, when an artisan makes a vessel, once he or she completes the work, the vessel no longer depends upon the artist. When my wife makes a piece of pottery, she can sell it. We found a piece of Arnold Schwarzbart's pottery sold online. The person didn't recognize what it was and was selling it stupidly. And, you know, like a good, you know, like one of those shows where they find this incredibly valuable blunderbuss on sale for a few pennies. We had that experience. And to have something of his artistry, but not to have him in our lives, is very powerful. But God is not like that, say our books. If God would forsake God's power creatively, everything would return to chaos. And somehow that is not factual, but it is true to me. I want to leave you with that. This is a place where I think it is true that if God is not present in our lives on a regular basis as part of the wood and the air and our heart and our skin and our love and our devotion, the world is a chaos again, and science can't help us. I don't know if I have a punchline for all this, except the struggle to live among the worlds of science, math, biology, physics, faith, art and nature, and to see God threaded through all of those things. And I hope you do. I know that I do.